Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey friends, welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. This is the weekly highlight reel of videos that I have put out on YouTube. So in case you don't know, you can go over to YouTube and watch all of my videos. The channel is History and Coffee, and you can just search for my name as well, Heather Tesco, History and Coffee, and you will get it. And you can subscribe there. Thank you to the many people who already subscribe. And then what I've started doing is weekly highlight reels of some of the videos that have gone out on YouTube that would be of interest to the podcast listeners as well. So thanks for listening. And you can also, like I said, go over and join me on YouTube, History and Coffee, and search for Heather. And there I am. So let's get right into it. This month is Women's History Month, of course. And we're going to start it off today with a look at a day in the life of various types of Tudor women. So I've done episodes that are like a day in the life of, we did like a day in the life in London, a day in the life in 16th century Cambridge, a day in the life of different types of people. And the one comment that always comes back to me, which is totally valid, is that it's all stuff that men are doing. And that is true. And there's a reason for that, because of course, men were doing things that went in the record. So women were not... Nobody was writing until later on, towards the end of the 16th century, beginning of the 17th century, when there were like household books and books about how to keep your household, things like that. People weren't really writing very much in the record about what women were doing, right? Women weren't at guild meetings that were being recorded. Women weren't at parliament, which was, you know, where a lot of records come from. Women weren't starting businesses, doing things like that would have been recorded, right? So it's kind of one of those real missings from history that we don't have these very clear records of what women were doing that during that time. We do start to get, and later on in Women's History Month, we're going to talk about letters. We do get a picture from letters that women were writing, and especially as literacy improved. That is one of the beautiful things about Protestant Reformation was, and I say this as an Episcopalian, but it doesn't matter. The effect that it had was to create more literacy, a literacy boom. That combined with the printing press, it's one of those really beautiful little serendipitous things that happen in history. We've got the printing press and the Protestant Reformation with its emphasis on having a direct relationship with God and having the Bible in the vernacular, having people being able to read the Bible directly, right? That leads to this huge boom in literacy that we didn't have before. So again, by the end of the 16th century, we start to get more letters, we start to get diaries, things like that, that we don't have in the beginning. So we're going to talk about all that and more this month on Women's History Month. So today we are going to talk a little bit about a day in the life of typical Tudor women, looking at a more lower class, peasanty sort of woman and noble women and how their days diverged. I'm also going to go on a 30-second rant from something that was in one of the comments. So one of the things about the Tudor period was, of course, there were these vastly different strata of society. But one thing that's pretty cool that we do see during this period that I think makes it very interesting is the rise of this merchant middle class that we hadn't seen before. In the medieval period, it was serfs and nobles. There were some, but not a lot in the middle class. And that's one thing we really start to see in the Tudor period is this rise of this middling class. But the social hierarchies, of course, deeply influenced the lived experiences of the women themselves, from the regal chambers of the noble women to the humble hearths of the peasants. So let's talk about morning routines. If you have watched anything like The Crown or Downton Abbey or anything like that, you know that the noble would wake up with the maid opening the curtains and saying, "Oh, good morning." And the maids would have been there ready to assist with any kind of elaborate morning rituals that the noble women had. And for both noble women and peasant women, no matter whether you're later with Elizabeth in the Protestant period or earlier with Henry VII when everything was still Catholic, prayers would have been the first order of business. So no matter what class you were, you wake up and you start with your prayers because, of course, these rituals through the day kept people rooted. And of course, there was this intertwining with daily life, with ritual observance of religion and the different religious practices. So that would have been the first order of business. For noble women, the process of dressing was an art in itself. You would have had these layers of garments with intricate laces. They would have had to have been kind of tied into them. It was a process, right? Contrastingly, a peasant woman would have greeted the day with the crow of the rooster, their morning devoid of any leisure as they plunged right into the day's demands after their morning prayers. Their homes, often simple one-room cottages, buzzed with activities as they stoked the hearth, prepared the meals, and tended to the animals, all before the sun fully made it into the sky. The absence of maids or servants in their world meant that their hands were responsible for every task, from mending garments to kneading bread, their routines shaped by necessity and resilience. Going into household management, for noble women, the household was a place where they governed, they ruled. It demanded astute management skills, kind of like running a small village. These women would have been like the conductors of a symphony orchestra, with all of these different servants, each with their own very specific roles. Their days were punctuated with things like meal planning for feasts and even intimate gatherings. There would have been a lot of entertaining as part of their lives. So they would have spent a lot of time planning the meal, planning the shopping, planning things like that. Social gatherings, of course, weren't just leisure activities, but they were strategic platforms for alliances and displays of status and wealth, each event carefully orchestrated to reflect the family's prestige. Peasant women in their own domain faced a different sort of challenges. Their homes, lacking in grandeur, were still the centers of relentless activity. The management of their household meant that they had to make do with limited resources to provide for their families. They were cooking, cleaning, child rearing, and that was interspersed with the rhythms of agricultural life. Their responsibilities extending beyond the threshold of their house into the fields and the markets where they contributed to the family sustenance. Work responsibilities. Noble women's roles extended into the realms of estate management, especially, women would be home a lot while their noble women would be home while their husbands were at court. So they had to know how to manage the estate. They also ran charitable endeavors. Their influence would quietly shape the political and the religious landscape of their area, of their time. Their job while their husband was away in London at Parliament or at court was to really keep their status in their home area, to keep everything running, to make sure their reputation was as good as always, to make sure no power was lost, everything like that. So they really had a lot of responsibility, especially when the husband was away. And that it makes me think, we see these themes, especially thinking about Women's History Month, when men went away to fight in wars. I'm thinking World War I and World War II, like Rosie the Riveter, the We Can Do It girl, woman, that women would take on these roles that were traditionally men's roles while the men were away. And then the men would come back and there must have been this feeling of like, I can manage your estate as good as you can. I look at how more 20th century women had dealt with that and how that led to the women's movement and everything, different waves of feminism. And I just wonder kind of what it was like for them, for those noble women, if they'd spent 6 months or a year managing the estate, keeping everything running while the husband was at Parliament, at court, and then the Lord comes back and he's like, all right, I'm here, I'm back, I'm in charge. And that must have been a weird dynamic for them, don't you think? Must have been a little weird. Some of these women then would be patrons of arts, of education, using their resources to support monasteries, hospitals, scholars, weaving their legacy into the fabric of society. Peasant women, on the other hand, their hands are etched by their hard labor. They engaged in the essential work of agriculture or whatever trade their husband was in. Of course, they would be helping their husband if their husband was a baker or, you know, anything like that. They would be right in there helping. Their work was directly tied to the land's yield, to the yield of their family. Markets were arenas where they showcased their produce and their goods, from fabrics to ales. Their entrepreneurial spirit, a vital undercurrent to the economy. Despite the constraints of their class, their contributions were no less significant, sustaining and enriching the community with their labor and crafts. Well, moving on to the afternoon activities. For noble women, their afternoons were often reserved for leisure, for the pursuit of personal interests in their tapestry-lined grand chambers and their grand homes. They would do embroidery, which was a very valued skill that would allow them to express their creativity while also producing beautiful works that they could give as gifts or use in the household. They would play music on the lute or the virginals. Some even composed their own pieces. Many of them would then also read, with literature ranging from chivalric romances to religious texts. These afternoons were also the perfect opportunity to host or attend a social gathering, where they could engage in conversation with their fellow noble women, exchange news, and solidify alliances within their social circles. Contrastingly, for a peasant woman, her afternoon was pretty much just like the morning, with work in the fields and at home and in her husband's trade. The division between work and leisure was very blurred, as their responsibilities to their families and communities persisted. They might spend their time tending to the vegetable gardens, feeding the livestock, finishing up the day's agricultural work. In some cases, they would engage in communal work, such as helping with a neighbor's harvest or participating in the village maintenance. Despite the hard work, there was a sense of camaraderie and mutual support within these communities. Now let's talk about their education and skills briefly. The chasm between the education of a noble woman and a peasant woman was, of course, huge. Noble women had access to tutors who taught them not only literacy, but also languages such as French and Latin, essential for communication within and beyond England's borders. They were also instructed in rudimentary mathematics, because remember, they had to manage the estate while their husbands were gone. So they actually did know some math. They also learned some of the arts, like we talked about, playing music. Instruments, dance, painting, all of this were things that noble women were schooled in if they were, you know, lucky enough to have those tutors, if their family provided them for them, which most of them probably would, because they wanted to have an educated daughter like that who could be a good partner for her future husband. Peasant women, on the other hand, they were educated in practicality and in survival. For them, schooling was very rare. Instead, they would learn essential skills from their mothers and from their communities. Herbalism for treating family ailments, weaving, sewing, clothing repair, agricultural knowledge to support the family. Their education was not written in books, but passed down through generations in oral traditions and hands-on experiences. We're going to talk a lot also this month about marriage and family life. We talked a little bit about marriage last month during Love Month. This month, we're also going to talk about it more. Marriage in Tudor England varied dramatically across social strata. For noble women, marriages were generally arranged. They would marry early, or at least be betrothed early, to strengthen political alliances to improve the family's social standing. These marriages were negotiated by families. They involved intricate dowries or contracts. Love was a secondary consideration, if considered at all, with many noble women meeting their husbands for the first time at the altar. Peasant women still faced societal pressures, but they had a lot more agency in choosing their partners, often marrying for love or practical partnership. Their marriages were simpler affairs focused on mutual support and shared labor of running a household and farm. Dowries were still exchanged, but were very modest, often consisting of livestock, land rights, or household goods. Moving into the evening, evenings for noble women were times of refinement and entertainment. Of course, the main meal would have been held earlier, but they would still have a dinner. A lot of times they would be hosting people, they would have entertainment, masks, showcasing their wealth and the wealth of the household. The household would probably gather for prayers before enjoying the evening entertainment, such as dances, plays, or musical performances, often with guests from neighboring estates. In contrast, a peasant woman's evening was focused on family and community. After their simple dinner, they might gather around the fire for storytelling, or singing folk songs, or just sharing the day's news with each other. These moments, though humble, were vital for maintaining the social fabric of the village, offering a rare chance for leisure and bonding in their labor-intensive lives. Let's talk about the challenges and hardships that the Tudor women had depending on which class they were in. Tudor women, irrespective of their class, still faced formidable challenges. So childbirth was something that definitely did not discriminate, with limited medical knowledge and high maternity mortality rates. Legal rights also for women were minimal, their identities and properties subsumed under those of their fathers and husbands. This was true whether you were a noble woman or you were the poorest peasant woman. Societal expectations confined women to roles that limited their autonomy and silenced their voices in the public arena. Yet, these women became masters at the soft power, finding ways to influence their families and their communities behind the scenes within the constraints of the period. And so there we go, a little bit about the day in the life of a Tudor woman, depending on what class she was in. Today, we are talking about Robert Catesby and his wife, Catherine Lee. So Robert Catesby is famous for having been part of the Gunpowder Plot, one of the main planners of the Gunpowder Plot. And yet, there was actually a time before he planned to kill King and Parliament. The loss of his wife, Catherine, may have, probably did, contribute to his downward spiral. And it's one of those what-ifs of history. What if Catherine hadn't died? Would he have become one of the plotters? Would he have been involved as he was? Would the Gunpowder Plot have even happened without him? So let's discuss. In the 16th and early 17th century, of course, England was a nation torn between religious ideologies. Protestantism gained ground and Catholic recusants, those who remained loyal to the Pope and to the Catholic doctrine, faced increasing persecution. Amidst this tumultuous backdrop, two lives intertwined. Robert Catesby, who was a fervent Catholic, and Catherine Lee, a Protestant from a prestigious lineage. On her mother's side, she was actually related to Alice Spencer, which is cool. We talked about Alice Spencer a couple of weeks ago. So their union, bridging opposing faiths, offered a poignant microcosm of the largest religious struggles defining the era. But as we delve into their lives, we can also ask, how did the personal relationships, faith, and societal pressures shape the destiny of a man who would come to orchestrate one of England's most infamous conspiracies? Robert was born in 1572 from the illustrious Catesby lineage. They were descendants of William Catesby, who was a counselor of Richard III, who met his end at the Battle of Bosworth. This legacy of political involvement was not lost on Robert's immediate family, who staunchly upheld their Catholic beliefs amidst a rising tide of Protestant influence. His parents, in particular, bore the brunt of their convictions. They endured imprisonments and even faced trials, notably for harboring the renowned Jesuit Edmund Campion. Robert's ties to the Catholic cause were further cemented through the Throckmortons, relatives who were synonymous with Catholic recusancy in England. Their history was riddled with persecution and also plotting against the Queen sometimes. Sir Thomas Throckmorton, the family's head, grappled with fines and imprisonments due to his faith. And then there was Francis Throckmorton, who was executed. He was implicated in the plot, one of the plots to free Mary, Queen of Scots. These formative influences drawn from his family's staunch commitment to their faith would come to shape Robert Catesby's perspectives, his actions, and ultimately his fate. 1593 was a major turning point for Robert Catesby's life. Despite the staunch Catholicism entrenched in his lineage, he found himself engaged to Catherine Lee, a Protestant from the respected Lee family of Stoneleigh in Warwickshire. Their union was not merely a testament to the personal affections between the two. It was, of course, arranged. From the perspective of Robert's family, especially his mother, she would have been interested in him being aligned with a more respectable family that didn't have kind of the worries of Catholicism, the potential threats of being a recusant. She might have seen that the future was going to be Protestant and it would be good for him to be aligned with a Protestant family. The Lee family also had a lot of money, and the Catesbys were suffering in that respect from having lost so much to fines for being Catholic. But also the two really were in love, which is amazing for that time period for arranged marriages. So Catherine's background was emblematic of Protestant England. Her grandfather, Sir Thomas Lee, had led the procession at Queen Elizabeth's coronation. It was a crucial ceremonial role during a time when Elizabeth sought to firmly establish Protestantism. Despite such deep-seated religious differences, the bond between Robert and Catherine was palpable. Their union bore two sons, though only Robert, named after his father, lived beyond infancy. Catherine's Protestant status seemingly afforded Robert a degree of relief from the recusancy laws, which were so rigorous at the time. His marriage to her offered him a protective camouflage, as it were, as he didn't immediately stand out as a Catholic recusant due to his Protestant wife. However, personal and societal tragedies were looming on the horizon. In 1598, only 5 years after their marriage, Catherine met an untimely death. I don't think people know exactly what she died of, at least I can't find it. But in a historical fiction book that I've been reading, they kind of pointed to probably some type of summer illness, summer fever. But I don't think there's an exact cause in the records. His second son also died at this time as well. The ramifications of her passing were profound. Robert, in his grief, sought solace in his faith, embracing Catholicism even more fervently. While the couple had seemingly achieved a delicate balance between their diverging beliefs, Catherine's death acted as a catalyst, drawing Robert deeper and deeper into the Catholic cause. It's tempting to speculate on the trajectory that Robert's life might have taken had Catherine lived longer. She seemed to serve as a moderating influence, with their life at Chaselton reflecting a semblance of religious harmony. But in her absence, Robert's radicalism grew. By 1601, he was entrenched in the Essex Rebellion, which, of course, the Earl of Essex did an episode on that about maybe a month or so ago. It was a rebellion against Elizabeth I. This period of rebellion also marked a stark contrast to the earlier years of his marriage. The depth of his devotion to Catherine and his profound grief that he experienced with her loss seemed to intensify his commitment to the Catholic cause. As England's religious climate grew more volatile, Catesby's path towards infamy was set, a path from which he would never turn back. Post Catherine's death, the shadows of Robert Catesby's radicalism became more profound. The financial repercussions of his involvement in the Essex Rebellion forced him to sell his estate, and he grappled with a world where he felt increasingly marginalized due to his faith. However, the shifting political sands after Elizabeth's death in 1603 seemed to offer some hope to the English Catholics. James I's succession was seen with optimistic eyes. Many believed that he would usher in an era of religious tolerance. He had been raised Protestant, and yet his mother was killed. She was a Catholic. So, you know, maybe he would have a little bit of tolerance for everybody. However, this optimism was short-lived. James I's reign became an antithesis to these hopes, and Catesby felt the pressing weight of disillusionment. This was rooted not only in religious dogma, but also in personal losses too. In a world without Catherine, his zealousness found no counterbalance. His once private faith transformed into a public cause as he embarked on a mission to recruit other like-minded Catholics. This mission was not solely focused on passive resistance. Of course, it aimed for violent regime change. names like Thomas Wintour, John Wright, Thomas Percy, and Guy Fawkes started revolving around Robert Catesby. This cohort of plotters envisioned a drastic and dramatic act, completely ending the Protestant government by blowing up the king and the House of Lords. The gunpowder plot was not just about the explosion. It was an intricate plan that envisioned a post-last England, one where a Catholic monarch would be reinstated. However, internal rifts and ethical dilemmas arose. Friar Henry Garnet, the underground Jesuit superior, appealed for the cancellation of the plot, fearing wide-scale implications and the backlash that it might provoke. Yet the plotters moved ahead, undeterred. The meticulous planning behind the gunpowder plot, unfortunately for Catesby and his cohorts, came to an abrupt end. An anonymous warning to William Parker, the fourth Baron Monteagle, unearthed the conspiracy. So then, of course, the plotters fled. Guy Fawkes was captured and tortured. He gave Robert Catesby's name. There was a last stand of sorts in Staffordshire. The plotters took the final communion and had their final confession, which, of course, is a sign that they probably knew they weren't going to live for much longer. And, of course, they didn't. Robert Catesby was shot and killed, and thus ended the pretty sad life of Robert Catesby. But the ghost of what might have been, of course, lingers heavily around Catesby's legacy. It's impossible not to wonder how Catherine's influence might have swayed Catesby's decisions had she been alive. Perhaps her presence could have steered him away from the path of violent rebellion, instead channeling his fervor into more peaceful avenues. In a period marked by religious tumult, political machinations, and personal tragedies, Robert and Catherine Catesby become a poignant reminder of the fine line between love, faith, and extremism. Catherine's memory, though overshadowed by the grander narratives of plots and betrayals, stands as a testament to the profound impact that personal relationships can have on historical trajectories. The what-ifs of their tale resonate deeply, echoing the timeless interplay of personal relationships amidst social upheavals. Thanks so much for listening to this week's YouTube highlights. Remember, you can go over and subscribe. History and Coffee, Heather Tesco, you will find me there. And we'll be back again next week with more highlights from what went out on YouTube throughout the week. Thanks so much. Have a great week.
Blow, northern wind, send for Mary sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.